for 1967 is when I went on active duty for the first time in the United States Air Force. And as a consequence of that, I headed over to a place called Vietnam, Southeast Asia, where I spent approximately 2 years in the U.S. Air Force and having some interesting times providing maintenance and flying combat missions on B-52s and KC-135s. Well, today we know that the Vietnam War has had a horrible effect on all of us that were Vietnam vets. The Vietnam War has had a horrible effect on everybody and all the family members that were involved in it. We're still having Vietnam vets to this day that are still getting sick and having medical problems. We're still having Vietnam vets are still not getting the medical care that they earned as a result of service to our nation, and especially with everything associated with Agent Orange. Well, along with all this stuff and how this stuff affected us, each and every one of us has had a different effect or a different result of when we've gone to war or when we served in the military. And tonight we got John Amadon, and I want to welcome John. Thank you for joining Warrior Connection. John, you're a Vietnam vet yourself. You were in the U.S. Marine Corps, correct?
Yes, I was in the Marine Corps from 1965 to 1969.
Let me interject something if I can. Most importantly, today, John is a member of Veterans for Peace, and he's taken that experience from Vietnam and applied it in a dramatically different way. And this is Patricia Axelrod, and I'm with the Desert Storm Think Tank and All Veterans Advocate. So please, John, go on.
Well, I wanted to make it clear, too, that I didn't actually deploy to Vietnam. I was sent to Okinawa in my years in the Marine Corps, which were from 1965 to 1969. I consider that very lucky, too. I was really blessed not to go to Vietnam.
Yeah, what was your, going in there, I mean, we've all had horror stories about what happened in basic training with the U.S. Marine Corps, either at Parris Island or where out there on the West Coast. Could you describe a little bit of your experiences, as you went through basic training with the U.S. Marine Corps back in the middle 60s, and how that has influenced your entire life?
My platoon was investigated for brutality. I was in Parris Island in February of 1965, and one day I don't quite know why the drill instructor who was on duty became very upset with a recruit and hung him on a chinning bar. They lifted the recruit up, and the bar, he put his arms over it, and the bar went across his back, and they hooked his hands to this belt, and he hung there for a bit of time, not terribly long, because I guess it was a very painful position to be in. And then when the recruit fell off the bar, the drill instructor punched him in the stomach and then hit him in the head once. And then when he crumpled on the floor, he kicked him. And then two other recruits were told to drag him back to his bunk, and they did. And so this young man went down with his friend because he had signed up on the buddy system and protested of brutality. So my platoon was investigated for brutality. The drill instructor was relieved from duty temporarily until the investigation could be held. The other drill instructors got us together, and the senior drill instructor, made it very clear, in fact said, this is a quote as best I can remember, and I'm pretty sure it's damn accurate. He said to us, if any one of you scummy little pricks testifies against the drill instructor, we will kill you when you get back. And what's more, the drill instructors won't have to lend a hand on, put a hand on you men. And they looked at us and said, isn't that right, men? And everybody else looked around and said, yeah, we'll get them for you.
See, you guys were being inculcated to attack this man that was innocent of something and being tortured, essentially, and you were ordered to stand by and watch it, and then if you opened your mouth about it, you were going to be the next victim. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, we weren't ordered to stand by and watch it. It just kind of happened very quickly, and I really don't know what provoked the incident or why the drill instructor got upset, but we watched the recruit get beat, and then we were told by the others that they would kill us if we testified against the drill instructor. And honestly, to a man, we went down and said, we saw and heard nothing, sir.
That was, it's a whole thing, again, what we look at throughout the military and everything and all the time in the military I've spent, there's that culture that says You've got to go along with us. You've got to believe in us. You've got to support us. You have to do everything what we say. You have to be in your thoughts, your ideas, your actions, totally supportive, no matter whether it's right or wrong.
Yeah, the other part of it is that the military kills people to solve its problems. And really, if you become the problem, then you're the enemy, even if you're part of the same organization.
Oh, I learned that too well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was one of the events that shaped my life. I knew that the military, the Marine Corps was basically a lie, that there wasn't honor or integrity.
How old were you, John?
I was 17 at that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how old do you think that the other guys were there?
Well, they ranged in age, and but most of us were either between 17 and 21, 22.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that really profoundly affected your life, didn't it?
Yeah, it had a very strong impact on me. I mean, I found out I wasn't the person I thought I was. I thought I'd be courageous, and always speak the truth. And I found out, like most other people, that when you're really threatened with a death threat, you're likely to be silent. And I was. It wasn't one of the shining moments of my life. In fact, I felt quite guilty about it in most of my life. On the other hand, I am glad to be alive, and it has proved itself to be useful in doing counter-recruitment work with kids. And I've spent quite a bit of time suggesting to young people that there are better ways to get their education and safer ways. And I've worked in my high school to get full disclosure recruitment. Let's tell the kids the truth about the military. Let's talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. Let's talk about traumatic brain injury, alcoholism. We didn't know at that time about the epidemic of veteran suicide, 18 to 22 people roughly a day, veterans committing suicide. But that's part of what needs to be talked about too. The military experience is far from benign. In fact, it's a violent culture that can and does damage many, many young men and women.
This is really important, John, as you say this, because recruiters are going into high schools now, and maybe that's how you met your recruiter. They go into high schools right then and there, and they sign up these young people and in high school, and then they have what's called a delayed deployment. So after they graduate from high school, they go in. And they're only 16, 17 when the recruiters sign them up. So it's really important that you have the chance to impart some truth to them.
I remember when I came back from Vietnam for the first time, and I came home on leave, and a friend of my brother's had, pretty much got word on his draft notice, okay? This is 1969 or whatever, I don't know, 70.
How old were you, dear? You were real young, weren't you, Doug?
I was 18 when I went in.
But did you sign up earlier?
No, I had signed up after high school because I graduated in 1967, and at that time I graduated in the middle of my high school class, so any probability of going to college or getting a college deferment was zero.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I decided to do was look at all the alternatives, and because my academic qualifications and preparation and what I had in high school and the tests that I took, with the military, obviously I got, went into the U.S. Air Force and had an incredible education there in avionics and electronics and everything else, which has proven extraordinarily beneficial. But what had happened is the same thing is just, again, what John is talking about. And it was real interesting because, after you came back and, we were shaggy and everything else, and I had let my hair grow a little longer and everything else. And
that's in 1969 when you came back?
Yeah, this is 19, I don't remember when it was. It's when I came back from Vietnam one of the times. Might have been in June of 71.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, my brother's best friend was actually, had got word on his draft notice, and so he was going down to enlist. And it's very, very interesting because my brother's best friend is the godson of a very, very famous actor who came from Libertyville. And the godfather himself. And so what had happened is we went over there, and my brother and his friend and I went over the recruiters, and we're sitting there, and the recruiter's just feeding a line of bull and everything else beyond comprehension. And finally, my brother just turned to me and said, Well, Doug, you just came back after 2 years over there. Could you tell us a little bit about what the truth is in comparison to what the recruiter has just said? And then the recruiter looks at, wait a minute, who the heck? And I said, well, I'm Sergeant Rocky. And he about that time freaked out. And needless to say, my brother's friend did not enlist.
Good for him.
Yeah, good for him and all
good
this stuff.
Good for him, yeah. Good
you know,
for
so
him.
What had happened. So anyhow, John, I mean, this is about what your experiences and how it all led to it. I mean, obviously you had this experience in basic training with the U.S. Marine Corps at Parris Island, and everybody has heard horror stories, you know, very similar to what you said that have become legendary, you know, from the 60s and before and probably led into the present. What else happened, and how did it lead you into your being a man of peace? How did it lend to that direction?
Well, I mean, after I was sitting on Okinawa for a year and watching, you know, and reading, watching the news and reading what I could learn about the war, and listening to people who were R&R, it was very clear that we weren't going to win that war, and that the programs that McNamara was instituting were failures, and we all knew that, you know, we all. But the war continued to go on and on. And then when I got out in '69, well, I knew the war was a travesty, so I started demonstrating against the war as soon as I got out. Went to some of those major rallies down in Washington D.C. And actually, while we didn't fully know it at the time, we had a major impact on the Nixon administration. And then, of course, the Pentagon Papers were released by Daniel Ellsberg, and what we thought to be true was verified in documentation, much like Bradley Manning has done this country a great service today in releasing all the documents.
Explain for the benefit of those who might not know who Bradley Manning is, and even Daniel Ellsberg, because, you know, we have a lot of young people who might be listening, and they're not familiar with these names, and perhaps they're not quite up on it. So tell us who Daniel Ellsberg is and also who Bradley Manning is, just for those who might not know.
Well, very briefly, Daniel Ellsberg worked for the RAND Corporation, but he was also in the Marine Corps, a captain in the Marine Corps, and knew Vietnam well, and then later on he developed the protocol for the MX missile, in fact. But at a certain point in time, he released the Pentagon Papers, which exposed the lies about the war in Vietnam, and he was put on trial, but won his case, to make it brief. So he released all these top secret documents, and I'm not quite sure what year that was, probably in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. Possibly, I'm pretty sure it was the early 70s, in any case. And jumping now to Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning just recently, and I'd be amazed if people didn't know his name, but I suppose it's certainly possible, released a Trevor trove of documents, over 100,000 documents electronically, which were broadcast on WikiLeaks, different internet sites. And there was one particularly damaging tape called Collateral Murder, where an Apache helicopter attacks some Iraqis and machine guns them down in a neighborhood, I believe, in Baghdad.
Innocent
plus
people.
A whole host of other information about government spying.
You know what? One of the things interesting about Bradley Manning, there's still been no confirming documentation that he is actually the individual that released all these documents, because, again, when you work when the intel circles are inside like this, you would realize that a private like this doesn't really have access to all that information, much less being able to get it transferred to some disk of the amount of pages they had transferred and everything and transferred across. So
he was in IT, though, Doug. His MOS led him into that. He had access to that incoming and outgoing traffic.
Understanding, again, same thing. You know, again, the same thing with all the compartmentalized and everything. You don't necessarily have access. So that's one of the questions still rising. There's no doubt that the information was released.
Yes, that's
okay?
Right.
Okay, and the question still is, though, what really happened and for what purpose? But again, going on, it's continuing on. So
let me just say this about that, if I might. Bradley Manning, in my book, is a hero. And he, in fact, if indeed he is a man who released those all of that information, and he has served an invaluable service to America and the world at large by informing the world at large in America of their waste of tax dollars and the waste of the war in Afghanistan, just as Daniel Ellsberg, in fact, had served that same purpose. He, too, is a hero. So from my book, from where I stand, if indeed he was responsible for that, he's a hero. And I know Dan Ellsberg, and he will admit what he did, and he sure as hell is a hero.
Yeah, Daniel is. I mean, I've had the pleasure of working with and speaking with and, you know, staying together with Dan Ellsberg, and we've, you know, been out before as visiting scholars at university, so it's an incredible experience.
Yeah, I've done it, too.
Let's go back to John.
Yeah, in reference to Bradley Manning, I mean, he has claimed responsibility for releasing those documents. Yeah, he's on trial now and giving testimony about how he was tortured by in his captivity by the U.S. military. With treatment that is really horrific, solitary confinement, locked up 23 hours a day, forced to sit or stand, his clothes taken from him, etc. And it goes. I mean, there's quite a bit of testimony out there at this point, and he definitely has claimed responsibility for releasing those documents, according to what I have read.
I too have heard the same thing. So, guilty or not, I say that he's a hero. He's if he's taking responsibility and he's not guilty for it, he's taking the rap, the man's a hero. If he did it, he's a hero. And that's my book on that.
Yeah. So anyhow, John, let's continue on. So you've having all of these influences, impacts on your life, okay?
Yes.
And how did this progress and lead to where you are today and what you're interested in trying to do today?
A lot of different things have obviously happened over the years. At a certain point in time, I started going down to Central America, and there I started seeing the conditions in Guatemala. I was started
that was in
going
the
down.
The 80s, wasn't it, John?
Yeah, the late 80s. In Guatemala, it was really a bloody mess. In the mid 80s, early 80s, mid 80s. By the time I ended up traveling in Guatemala, it had quieted down considerably, so it wasn't. It wasn't nearly as threatening, and there weren't the war had pretty much subsided. Every now and then there would be a minor skirmish, but.
And for the benefit, John, of those who don't know, if I could interject, the wars in Central America, which were taking place in the 80s, this was a struggle of the people, the so-called peasant class of people who were struggling against the oligarchy, trying to throw off the chains of slavery, essentially, is what they were doing. And the U.S. was sponsoring these wars because they were fearful of the so-called domino effect. They were fearful that these countries would become communist countries. So the U.S. was, in fact, lending material aid and support. And there was in Guatemala and El Salvador, we had what was called the death squads down there, murdering thousands upon thousands of people, torturing people who stood up against the oligarchy, the rich, the powerful, all the landowners. Am I right on this, John?
Yes, you are right. And then we learned in 1993 in a very wide way through a Newsweek article about the School of the Americas, where Latin American soldiers were brought up and trained by the U.S. Army at Fort Benning, Georgia. Previous to that, the school had been in Panama, had been dubbed the School of the Assassins, and it was such a vile institution, or the School of Coups, and the Panamanians kicked it out, so the U.S. military brought it up here, and it is still ongoing. It is now presently called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. In any case, I didn't know that at the time, but in 93, that was the missing piece, because when I was in Guatemala and I looked at the culture and the poverty, I wondered where all the money was coming from to fund the war. And I found out that a great deal of it was coming from U.S. taxpayer dollars, my money, and the travesty and the violence and the suppression of the people was really a part of U.S. foreign policy. Much to my dismay. So I became involved in working to close the School of the Americas at that point. And that struggle is still ongoing. In fact, technically speaking, the Army did close the school for a month as a pretext and subterfuge and then reopened it under a new name.
Reorganized it, exactly. Yeah.
What is happening with the School of Americas? What kind of courses do they have there? Or what are they involved in? What nations do they have involved?
And what's it called again now, John? It's
called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation.
Oh, goodness gracious.
And essentially they do combat training for the military. I mean, allegedly and supposedly there are some courses in democracy and human rights, but they're, this is a school that, you know, is taught in Spanish and taught actually by... as I understand it, unless things have changed a bit, but it was formerly taught by Latin American military. And it was a real perk. I mean, you'd come up here, you'd buy things, you'd bring some money, you'd buy things, you'd be taken to the Atlanta Braves ball games and Disneyland while you were here. And it was a place to go, you know.
Let's not forget that they had a course in torture there. They actually taught, and I presume they're still doing it, they taught torture techniques, effective ways of extracting information from detainees.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
And in any case, so I became involved in that issue and working with that. And as you go along, I mean, you become exposed to different influences, and as time moved along, I continued working on the School of the Americas, but then the Middle Eastern wars began happening, Desert Storm, you know, to begin with, and then later on the next war with Iraq, shock and awe. And became involved in those issues. And at some point in time, too, and I'm not really clear, oh, I know why, because I was friends with Sister Megan Rice.
Oh, yes, and, the Nevada test site people, right.
Right, but Sister Megan protested the School of the Americas also, and she did 6 months in Danbury Prison for protesting the School of the Americas, trying to make the government aware of, you know, how murderous a program this turned out to be. And for her very good efforts at that point in time, she was sent to Danbury Prison. The charge, I guess, was trespassing. And she was found guilty. In any case, later on, she moved out to the Nevada Desert Experience. And later on, I began helping her organize some demonstrations out at the Nevada test site. And I guess that began my involvement with nuclear issues.
And you were the interim director of the Nevada Experience, is that right?
Yeah, there was one year I was actually a paid staff and the interim director.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then, for those people, again, on the Nevada test site, I spent a lot of time out there, and I actually conducted my own research for the Army out there at the Nevada test site.
Doug knows that place probably better than many, many people, right, Doug?
Yeah, you know, it's real interesting because, you know, when we all got exposed out there and we got, you know, trashed out by the radioactive materials from the weapons we were designing, testing, and using and blowing everything up with, I mean, you know, the Renner's aluminum and the people out there, you know, obviously they were going to do the medical testing, and they obviously did right away. And in my own case, they did the testing within minutes after I came out of the research field after we had been blowing up and burning stuff and, I mean, having a really good time. But then they never told me for 2.5 years that the test results had come back, that I was, you know, 5,000 times permissible level. And that, you know, has directly affected my life and obviously all the rest of my team. And, I mean, that's part of what the reality is. Well, the Nevada test site, I mean, John, could you explain a little bit about what the Nevada test site, I mean, it's the Department of Defense, the Department of Energy, Nuclear Regulatory Commission site. Could you explain what the Nevada test site is and what's involved out there and what they're currently doing?
Well, actually, they've changed the name. It's been rebranded, so it's—I believe it's now called the Nevada National Security Site.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah, this is all weapons speak here. They've got
right.
going on here. Yeah, yeah.
And it's expanded, and it's not—you know—it's nuclear testing has wound down. It's the most bombed-out place on the face of the earth in terms of the number of nuclear explosions, with over 1,000 nuclear explosions taking place there. And in the 50s they did atmospheric testing still, and eventually learned that radioactive materials were traveling in the dust and winds and irradiating large parts of the country. In fact, I mean, I live in New York, and there are radioactive hotspots in the late 50s and probably early 60s, too, with radioactive rain falling on us at different points in time. And it's directly the contamination here. Thyroid cancer was a direct outcome of it. Of course, if you were much closer in Utah, Idaho, in states downwind, Arizona, then there were, you know, all types of different medical problems, cancer, birth defects. There were all the incidences of dead sheep, ranchers having their sheep mysteriously die. And it goes on and on and on.
Can I interject something here?
Sure.
Just for the sake of accuracy, there are many people who believe that the nuclear weapons programs have kind of died down at the Nevada test site. But I'm here to tell you, I too investigated this matter very thoroughly. I am bicoastal, with a foot in Nevada and a foot in Illinois, and I was a litigant in an effort to stop the first above-ground test of what would have been a nuclear detonation, and that was called Divine Strake in about 2003. And Doug, I know, knows this very well. I can assure you that indeed the Nevada test site, or whatever the hell you want to call it, we'll call it a weaponeer's wet dream for lack of anything else. I can assure you they're busily designing and engineering any and every type of weapon system they can involving nuclear materials. That what they're doing now is simulating this, but they're still doing it below ground. I can assure you that this is as active as it's ever been. It's only that, in fact, they cannot engage in underground actual testing and or above ground. But they're doing everything they can to controvert the treaties that would forbid this. And Doug knows this for a fact. For those who don't know who Doug is, Doug was in charge of the U.S. Army program for the development of what is euphemistically called depleted uranium. I'll call it radioactive weaponry. And Doug knows that joint, that place, probably better than anyone that you or I or anyone will ever talk to. And he knows full well what's happening there. They're designing a whole new class of tactical nuclear weapons there, including means and ways of dial-a-yield weaponry. So for the sake of accuracy, please let me correct that for the sake of the truth. Doug, you
know,
one
of the things, another thing, too, that's very interesting, and this has come to light again, from the weapons development and weapons use and everything else done at the Nevada test site, as the flights and everything were coming in and out, McClellan Air Force Base in Sacramento, California, got substantially contaminated. And, I mean, we were involved, you and I were directly involved, in getting the radioactive contamination on that site sealed. Now, which is real interesting, recently here in the last 6 months, Dr. Ted Hawley, who's in charge of the Air Force Environmental Remediation Program for the Department of Defense and the U.S. Air Force, and they keep changing their name again, rebranding their acronym. But what he told me personally a few months ago, and Patricia, you've heard this already, and we know it's happening, they have made a conscious decision to try and do some minimal mitigation of the radiological contamination that exists in the creeks and everything else and all throughout McClellan Air Force Base. So they have let the contracts.
Oh, no. Don't tell me they're doing this, Doug.
Yeah, and they are. And, you know, and again, what the extent is going to be and how it's going to be done and everything is still up for question. Again, part of the discussions, I know, talking to Dr. Ted Hawley, I mean, that is what's been done. And it was very interesting because when he told me this, he said, you know, I understand you guys were part of the team that
shut it down. We stopped the development of that. They were going to build a whole city on that.
Yeah, they were going to do a housing development on that contaminated site.
We were in the whole deal. We stopped it.
Yeah, so anyhow, we're looking at a continuation.
Yeah,
John, I mean, you're looking at the Nevada test site. You're out there working with stuff. What kind of response did you have from the community or the government as the work you were doing?
Yeah. Well, a couple quick things about the Nevada test site. According to the Treaty of Ruby Valley, it's really Western Shoshone land, which was seized, and it ought to be returned to the Western Shoshone. And I wanted to put that in there. The second thing is that Google Earth actually disclosed that there was a landing strip built. It's a very large tract of land. Bought a test site, and there was a secret landing strip built, which Google Earth revealed with a drone on it. And so there's a connection with drones, and of course, Creech Air Force Base is about about 13 to 15 miles away from the Nevada test site, right on Highway 95. Creech is in Indian Springs, and the Nevada test site is just up the road at the Mercury exit.
Well, you know, this is really important because this brings us to President Obama's weapon of choice here. Not that he ever met a weapon he didn't love. He's addicted to war. But his weapon of choice is the drone. And, you know, John, that you know this very well because, of course, you are actively engaged in opposition to the drones. And in Pakistan, where it's most frequently deployed, and also, of course, in Somalia.
And Yemen,
right. But in Pakistan alone, since 2004, they've killed almost 4,000 people with these drones. Tell to us about this, John.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because I live in Albany, New York now, and about 130 miles up the road is Syracuse, New York, and this Hancock field. It's an Air Force base, and their drones are operated. So I've been involved with the Upstate Coalition Against Drones, and actually been arrested protesting drones at Hancock Airfield, along with a number of other folks. The arrest I was in was interesting because it was a preemptive political arrest. They charged us all with parading without a permit. We were walking in single file along the road, and the police came and swooped down and blocked us and arrested the whole parade, and then decided to let about 20 people go and arrested 33 of us. And it was clearly an attempt to block our First Amendment rights, free speech. And as citizens, you know, we do the civil resistance to inform our government to make them aware of their illegal activities, murder to be exact, and with drones and hellfire missiles and bombs. So these charges actually were dismissed against us because when we actually read the ordinance used by the Onondaga Sheriff's Department, we hadn't, in fact, violated even the parading ordinance, and in the interest of justice, the town attorney had the charges dismissed. Just recently, on October 25th, I was back up at Hancock Field, not arrested that day, but 17 of my friends were. For again protesting drones, this particular day we blocked all three gates in a very successful action, and so their trials are going on. But at this point, a Colonel Evans had the town of DeWitt issue a restraining order against the 17, a personal restraining order, a new tactic to deny us our First Amendment rights. And none of the defendants actually ever heard of Colonel Evans before or knew of him. And
Colonel Evans,
obviously we're committed to nonviolence, and so there was no threat made against him.
Right.
At all. I mean,
and
it's
Colonel
just
Evans
an incredible
is the commanding
travesty
officer?
Of justice.
In charge of the drone program, would you say there?
He has a position in the program. I'm trying to find exactly what it is for you, but I have an article here somewhere with his position. Let's see if I can find it, though. As you know, when you're looking for something...
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
I grapple with a paper monster, as does Doug. Right, Doug? We got our own paper monsters. We know, right,
yeah,
Doug?
Yeah, okay, I got it. He is the Mission Support Group Commander of the 174 Fighter Wing Group, according to court documents.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things that's interesting in this
let's tie this together a little bit into the PTSD effects. I mean, personal, from your own experience, I mean, you obviously had a traumatic experience. You, again, in order to belong to the group and everything, chose to be quiet during the events of your basic training at the U.S. Marine Corps in Parris Island, and then obviously we went on to Vietnam. All of us had the same stuff, where in order for us to be part of the group, we buy into, we ignore what's happening around, we don't protest when we should, we don't bring attention to the individuals could do something about it in order to belong. And then when we look at all the stuff for more, I mean, today we absolutely know a proven fact the Gulf of Tonkin incident did not occur.
We do know that for a fact.
McNamara and Johnson made that all up to get us, you know, more involved in Vietnam.
Yeah, Doug, explain that, because, you know, we got some young folks that may not know what that's all about, Gulf of Tonkin.
And what had happened, basically, in 1964, the U.S. military made a statement that said that North Vietnamese ships had fired upon U.S. ships in what's called the Gulf and Tonkin area, which is off the coast, basically the coast of North Vietnam. And as a consequence of that, because there was a direct North Vietnamese engagement, that gave us justification to launch hundreds of thousands more U.S. military going into Vietnam. And obviously I bought into it, and I went over there, and I flew missions, maintained the aircraft, and did a lot of killing for it. So, I mean, that whole thing we know today did not occur. That is a proven historical fact. I mean, even McNamara has come on down, you know, on his stuff on the Shining Lies and everything, even admitted all of this stuff. So all this stuff is coming around. The other thing I know for me, I mean, you have to understand, Patricia and I have talked about this, John, and you can understand this, Thanksgiving is real bad. I went back to Vietnam for the second time on Thanksgiving Day, 1969. I went to Desert Storm on Thanksgiving Day of 1990, and I got off active duty after serving as the director of USR Depleted Uranium Project on Thanksgiving Day in 1995. So it's, you know, Thanksgiving Day and then the first week of December. But when we look at all this stuff has happened, and we have to look at the wars we've been involved in, what we've done, what the individual warrior, the soldier does in order to belong to the group, in order to sustain everything and get promoted. As you just said, John, when you were in basic training, you turned the other way.
I did. But, you know, I mean, the death threat was real.
Very real problem.
And I had, I didn't have good alternatives, obviously. Mm-hmm. So in my case, as soon as I could get out of the Marine Corps, in fact, I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all this comes into play, and I think this is extraordinarily important, because from Vietnam onwards, all the stuff that happened in all the engagements, you know, obviously Central America and everything else, the stuff continuing on with Desert Storm, and now to Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, we're seeing incredible levels of ethical and moral crises within all of the individuals. I mean, mm-hmm. what you basically described earlier, John, you hit the ethical and moral crisis as far as the abuse in basic training at Parris Island. You made a conscious choice to ignore at that time in order to belong to their group and continue on. Otherwise, you know, you're going to be history yourself real fast. Or they'll send you to Vietnam where you become history yourself real fast.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're looking at the ethical and moral crises. As you said, John, you've gone along, you've seen the stuff, you studied the investigations, whether it's the School of Americas or the drones or the Nevada site. Now, the thing where we're going to tie this back together now
mm-hmm.
is the PTSD, the alcohol and drug abuse. Now, John, didn't you, after you got out of the military, you went back to college, you spent some time in alcohol and drug abuse counseling, correct?
I worked as a crisis intervention specialist in Troy, New York, for the Alcoholism Center of Rensselaer County.
Mm-hmm. And how does that, you know, with the military and everything, today, I mean, we know the drug and alcohol abuse within the military and the PTSD is devastating. And I don't think it's changed. I mean, that was really even more so after Vietnam, wasn't
it? It's a parallel time, exactly, Doug. John was treating probably those Vietnam veterans who sadly had been completely demoralized and gutted, eviscerated by their experience. And yet another experience in John's life that leads us right back to today. Exactly. Round robin we come, all the way round again. John?
Yes. Actually, I mean, my experience in working with alcoholics, I was working with an older population, And I suppose some of them were Vietnam vets, but most of them were street alcoholics and probably too old at that point, because I was in the 70s, and these gentlemen were older men.
Could they have been World War II veterans?
Well, they could have been.
I can tell you that right now. It's the same thing. War is an unnatural state for the human condition. When we're here in America, we're taught that it is unlawful, that it is unethical, immoral. It is a sin to kill. And when you're brought into war, be it World War II, Vietnam, Desert Storm, whatever war it might be, and all of a sudden you have to throw all of that out, and you have to learn how to kill, how to murder, how to become part of organized murder, then it does have its toll on the human soul. And I would bet you that some of those folks that you treated, they might have been World War II veterans, and they may have still been suffering the effects.
John, when we look at this stuff, I mean, here's some more we can help individuals, because obviously we're seeing alcohol and drug abuse, and I've been involved with the current veterans and helping them. We've been very fortunate to get the drug courts put into place and get those referred for professional care. John, could you describe some of the things that, with alcohol and crisis intervention, the problems that you encounter, you see, or what can be done to help these individuals?
At that time, the population I was primarily working with, I mean, was incredible. There was a change in the law which made public intoxication had previously been a crime and now was no longer a crime. So people who would have enforced sobriety due to lockup were no longer locked up. And while in some ways the law was an improvement, in some ways it wasn't. And some of these gentlemen would be drunk 300 days a year. I have never seen people who had a capacity to drink so much alcohol. And
doesn't the body adjust and adapt where you continuously drink, that the body can adapt and you can consume incredible quantities? I mean, you're going to definitely be drunk.
Oh, yeah, it definitely adapts and it definitely takes its toll. And for this particular population, in all honesty, at that particular time, there wasn't effective treatment modalities. Alcoholics Anonymous was used. Clients who were found suitable, who we thought we could treat, were sent to state facilities and treated. And honestly, I think a fair amount of these men just died as alcoholics.
As will a lot of the young men who are now our veterans. But we're coming up to 6:43 now. And John, we want to hear about your experience with Dan Ellsberg and the MX missile 3. And we know from our program last week that the U.S. has invested and is committed to invest about $370 billion in refurbishing and our nuclear weapons program and in adding new weapons. So tell us about that, John.
Yeah, well, it's we were on February 25th, a group of us were protesting a Minuteman III missile launch at Vandenberg Air Force Base, and we were...
And Dan Ellsberg was with you.
Dan Ellsberg was with us, Father Louis Vitale, Cindy Sheehan, David Krieger, the president of Nuclear Age Peace Foundation from Santa Barbara, his wife, a number of women from Code Pink, myself and other people from Veterans for Peace were there too. And so anyway, we crossed the line to ask that the Minuteman III missile not be launched because it's in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and our obligations towards disarmament. And what people really need to know about the ICBMs, the intercontinental ballistic missiles, are that they are, even from a military standpoint, they are no longer needed, and they present a fixed target. There are 450 missiles on high alert, and it's a very dangerous situation because the decision to launch will be made within 13 minutes.
What you mean by high alert. Is that right, dear?
Yes.
Okay. Go on.
Yeah, from the time we think there's an incoming attack to the launch time, roughly 13 minutes precede, and the missiles are either launched or not. And then the theory is that the enemy would target them. The only adversary who has enough nuclear weapons, as far as we know, is Russia, and even China, I believe, only has a relatively small number of nuclear weapons, and their missiles are not on high alert, so they would take 24 hours to 72 hours to launch. So we need very much to get these weapons off of high alert, so that a reasonable chance to make a correct decision can take place. And there have been very close calls in a number of incidences where there are just miscalculations and accidents, and they are well recorded. There was a case in 1995 where we were doing a missile launch in Norway to study the Northern Lights. The communications with Moscow were ineffective in that the information wasn't relayed to the proper parties in Moscow, and the Russian military actually went to Boris Yeltsin and told him that they were under nuclear attack and that he had to make a decision to retaliate or not. And he had a very brief window of opportunity, too. Fortunately for all of us, he chose not to retaliate. He believed that he wasn't under attack, even though his military officials had informed him that they were. And he was right, and they learned later that it was a scientific rocket that we had launched to study the Northern Lights. There are a number of incidences. There was a computer chip one time that gave a false positive in our system. There was a training tape that was installed once and indicated that we were under a full nuclear attack. There is a movie called Countdown to Zero, a really excellent documentary, which speaks about all of these incidences. And we're under grave threat. I mean, the other thing that people really need to know is that it only takes 300 nuclear weapon explosions in cities to create a world that is no longer ecologically sustainable.
A nuclear winter, we call that, right?
Yeah, nuclear winter and nuclear famine, because the soot from burning cities, if 300 weapons were detonated in cities, and the ensuing fires would kick up all kinds of smoke and soot, and it would block 70% of the sunlight for 10 years. So we would basically all starve to death.
And that would halt photosynthesis. That would be the end of our world as we know it.
Well, right. the other problem we'll run into, just again, some research has been involved in everything, and I've taught the electric magnetic pulse, which is we can take a small weapon and just blast it at 10 miles up. And because of today's electronics, the solid-state communications and everything else, we're very physically going to totally disable all our communications assets and disable a lot of, obviously, you know, the vehicles today are on solid-state electronics. We're going to disable all of those. We're going to disable, you know, the medical community and everything else. So, again, just on one small byproduct, EMP, like the magnetic pulse from even a single detonation, is going to devastate an extraordinarily large region.
And it's going to set off a string of blasts, radioactive blasts, and nuclear blasts, all across the country and the world, because each time one goes off, it has a subsequent EMP blast. So you go into a chain reaction. It gives a new meaning to fission fusion here as we speak of what could be the effects. So, John, you folks, you good number of people there, including Daniel Ellsberg and Cindy Sheehan and so forth, you all go up to the people at MX Missile 3.
Minuteman 3.
Minuteman 3, rather.
And where was this at? Vandenberg?
Vandenberg Air Force Base. We're all arrested. Then the arraignment happened later on, and I believe it was in May. Our trial actually was October 17th.
And what happened?
We ended up with a fantastic legal team because they were asking for jail time for Father Louis Vitale, who is a serial peacemaker and arrested numerous times, and they wanted to put him in jail. And there was one other gentleman they wanted to jail. So he was entitled to a public defender, and we ended up with a really excellent lawyer who provided a masterful defense, him and his law firm. And they
they bought the trespassing charges. They subpoenaed the whole Air Force security detail. They challenged with pretrial motions and motions in limine the Air Force government witnesses. And
you mean their credibility?
Their credibility, their expertise, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the long and short of it was that the district attorney asked that the charges be dismissed. And
excellent.
So we, you know, normally what is a slam dunk, you know, an easy victory for the government, wasn't, and we won.
I think one of the most embarrassing things with a lot of these incidents, where you're looking at a lot of, you know, I mean, Daniel Ellsberg and some are looking at a lot of these Catholic priests, Catholic nuns, and other ones of other religions, where we've had some of these Catholic nuns in their 80s have been protesting. And what's really interesting, and I find this very disturbing from a, you know, from a military point of view, and I was involved in one of those trials, again, with a whole bunch up in Baltimore in federal trial. I got subpoenaed as an expert witness on this. But what had happened is these Catholic nuns and priests and other ones are basically very old, and they're protesting. They were able to get access to these classified areas, restricted areas.
And they're frail
and
small.
Which for me is frightening, because the U.S. Air Force, U.S. Army, the Marines, whoever is responsible for security of these areas should have this stuff so well secured that there would have been impossible for any of these protests to penetrate even into the perimeter, as they've done over and over again. And I find it interesting is why, when this is happening, why the military doesn't come back in itself and say, wait a minute, we've got a total failure here of our security. Because in this case, where you're a protester, you guys are all peaceful protesters. You're not the bad guys. You're not bad guys trying to do something. But there are bad guys out there, absolutely really bad guys all over. And if they can't maintain security against a handful of ancient Catholic nuns and priests and other protesters...
Well, I don't know that Sister Megan would like that, but go on.
I mean, so what does that say as far as the security capability of the Air Force and the Army to sustain these sites and operate these sites, which are essential for national defense, you know, in one sense or another?
Well, it says a lot.
Do you penetrate the parameters of the silo itself or the site?
Well, the Y-12 plant in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, was penetrated by Sister Megan and two gentlemen who are about 64 and 65, I think, two Catholic worker men. And they just cut through with vault cutters and went through the fences. And what was learned, and then they actually walked up to the vault where the highly enriched uranium was, and they beat on the walls of the building with hammers. And they were heard by people inside, but the people inside thought they were maintenance workers. And because maintenance workers apparently showed up at all hours of day and night and did things unannounced.
Mm-hmm.
But what was found was that security cameras had been inoperable, were broken, in fact, and needed repair, and hadn't been repaired for some of them for 6 months. And that in places where cameras were working, apparently the security folks weren't watching at the moment they passed through. I believe the security at this particular plant was provided by private security. But in any case, Sister Megan is an 82-year-old nun who has a heart condition and who walks slowly.
Mm-hmm.
She's you're
very
right.
Frail.
Is, and President Obama is working, you know, allegedly to secure nuclear materials all over the world, so that they won't fall into the hands of terrorists. And here are these three folks penetrate a supposedly a top secured plant. Let's make it look like a romp in the woods.
Let's face facts here. They're busy watching all of us so-called peacemakers and anti-war activists. They're busy enough spending millions and millions of dollars, billions of dollars, spying on us, and they can't even watch their own nukes.
Yeah, but the real point is that there is never enough security. We need to rid ourselves of nuclear weapons. We need to go to zero.
Exactly.
And that's the real point, and that's what Sister Megan and her two Catholic worker friends were trying to demonstrate, and that's what we were trying to do, make people aware with the Minuteman III missile. The missile needs to be taken off of high alert, and it needs to be decommissioned. It needs to be retired. The United States has over 5,000 warheads, and when we know that 300 will destroy life as we know it. Even General Cartwright recently said, let's bring it down to 900 warheads on our side.
Exactly.
You know? So let's, and that would be a great start.
We are now at 6:56, and before we go any further, John, and Doug, too, please, John, for those folks who want to contact Veterans for Peace, who are interested in what you're saying, who might be inspired to join Veterans for Peace because of what they've heard, or would like to follow your activities, won't you please give them some contact info, an email address, a phone?
Yeah, the easiest way to get a hold of Veterans for Peace and learn about it is go to our national website, which is veteransforpeace.org.
And what about you in particular, if they want to contact you, John?
Well, my number, my cell phone number is 518.
Slow.
518-312-6442, and you're welcome to call me.
Yeah, John, you know, you've been involved in everything and working with kids or thinking about going in the military or working with parents. What kind of suggestions, information, or recommendations can you give to them?
Did you repeat that, Doug? I missed part of it.
Yeah, if you're working with individuals that are considering enlisting in the military, okay?
Yeah.
What kind of suggestions, recommendations, or information or stuff can you give to these individuals who are considering, or their parents or their spouses? What do they need to consider and look at?
You know, I would send them to American Friends Service Committee, and they did a really excellent video, which I'm still sure is available, which is Before You Enlist. And that would be, and you can get a tremendous amount of very good information from AFSC. .org, and that's an organization I think very highly of, and they do full disclosure recruitment work all the time.
They're the Quakers, aren't they?
Yeah,
sure
they are.
Are
the Quakers.
Yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, again, education, information, we're Progressive Radio Network, we're moving forward. Thank you, John. Thank you, Patricia. Ladies and gentlemen,
thank you,
have a good evening.
Bye-bye.